From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, one of America's top ethicists is in town. We'll talk with Anthony Weston about ways to resolve some of the toughest ethical dilemmas of our time. Also, how both technology and globalization are changing legal practice. And novelist and essayist Thomas McGuane, best known for his books about the West and the outdoors. But first, should the city of Sacramento worry about the tens of millions of dollars it needs to get from the owners of the Kings if the team leaves town? Joining us to talk about that and other top stories in the news and sports is Marcus Bertone, the Sacramento Bee columnist, who joins us the first Wednesday of the month. Marcus, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, would you worry about that $76 million or so dollars that the Maloofs owe the city if they leave early?
I think the city's worried about it. I think the city is worried that this situation could turn into a dispute over how and when the money is paid or if the money is paid. I often hear from people say, well, it's in writing, right? Well, it is in writing, and I've read the contract, and I've had lawyers who read the contract for me, and it does say that the loan needs to be paid in full. But as we both know, as we all know, many legal documents are not followed these days, particularly with respect to paying large sums of money all at once. And I think that's what we're talking about. And also, the Maloofs, the Kings, could remain in agreement with the terms of the contract by defaulting.
Because there's collateral, there's the arena, and there's a stake in the team. And if I were to borrow money from a bank and I had collateral, I could walk away from the loan and they take the collateral.
Right. In this case, the collateral being the arena, about 83 acres around the arena, and a $25 million stake in the team. At present land values, you add all those things together and it doesn't add up to $77 million. It probably falls about $20 million short. And then there's all kinds of open questions, legal interpretations as to, say, if that happened, who makes up the balance, who gets stiffed essentially, whether it's the, and it may be that it's the bond investors who put up the money in the first place. We're talking about hedge funds, and it's even really hard to know the individuals who did so, but it would become potentially a huge legal issue that people would have to deal with. Now, the Kings owners have pledged that they're going to pay it. The mayor of Sacramento said, I don't believe that the NBA would allow that to happen. All those things being true, but we live in kind of extraordinary times, and the city does have reason to worry because the issue of paying off some of the loan never was an issue as long as the team was here. Now the team might be leaving. Now it's an issue.
Yes. And if those bondholders were to be stiffed, let's say it did come to that, that would have problems for Sacramento's good standing in the investment community.
Right. It says in the contract that the general fund would not be impacted, City of Sacramento's general fund. However, the city's reputation would definitely be impacted. The city's ability to amass short-term debt to, you know, plug up shortfalls from budget to budget would definitely be impacted. And so the more likely scenario would be at that point that the parties would all sit down and try to figure it out, protracted negotiations. You never know how those are going to go. They could be very lengthy, time-consuming, and costly. So clearly the city is jumping up and down saying, you're going to pay our money, right? Because the alternative to that is full of question marks.
Yes, because if the team were to leave early and if the Maloof said, here's the collateral instead of the money, the city would have to fork out tens of millions of dollars in that scenario at a time when they're dealing with a $40 million projected deficit.
$40 million deficit. Now, my guess is at that point the city would get with the bondholders and say, let's figure this out. I know what the contract says, but let's figure this out. But again, that becomes full of open questions. That becomes potentially very time-consuming and costly to figure out. Nobody wants to go into protracted litigation. And I do think that the mayor, there is something to be said for what the mayor said, that the NBA probably wouldn't want the black eye either of having a long-time NBA city left with that sort of a situation. It's all the unknown. It's one of these are all some of the many questions that are up in the air now, as it seems that the team's going to leave.
And who's in charge here from the city's point of view? There is no city manager, and there isn't even an interim city manager now. You've got a few assistant city managers, one of whom sent off these letters to the city of Anaheim, the NBA, and the Maloof, saying, you guys better watch out. The mayor, who does not have the executive power of our non-existent city manager, seems to be stepping back from this.
He's trying, it appears to me, he's trying to play the good cop, Jeffrey, in this scenario, and the bad cop, as it were, is John Dangberg, who's the assistant city manager, and it is a fascinating dilemma the city finds itself in that there's a complete power vacuum, and so you have people with the titles of assistant city managers, and let's not forget the city attorney is involved in this heavily as well, who are pressing the interests of the city. And that's all they can basically do, because the rest of this is completely out of the hands of Sacramento. This deal is going to rise or fall on whether on what the NBA decides will be the relocation fee, and the pressure to bear in that scenario are the Southern California teams, most notably the Los Angeles Lakers, who do not want another NBA team in their market. So this is going to be a test as to how much juice Dr. Jerry Buss, the owner of the Lakers, has with the NBA. Because if he's able to squeeze out a mammoth relocation fee, I believe, in my opinion, this deal will stop and the Kings will remain, at least for a year.
And part of the overall context for this is an apparent lack of groundswell among the good people of Sacramento. In 2002, if there'd been talk of the Kings leaving town, there would have been riots in the streets. Last night, there was a Here We Stay or Here We Build rally.
Here We Build.
A couple of hundred people showed up.
You know, I mean, you're having a rally that's sort of hastily organized at the very last minute at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday in downtown Sacramento, where there is limited parking. I don't know about the wisdom of that in terms of being able to turn out a big throng.
And it was relying on Kings fans, even though the Kings were about to start a game at 5:30.
Yes. People who really mean well, I don't know if they really thought that through. That probably there were a lot of people who were actually watching the Kings win. And that's the other very funny, interesting, sad, tragic part about this whole situation is that this team looks like it's finally making something out of itself. You can now see the horrible lessons learned in December, January, where they're giving games away. The little light bulb is going on over these very large men's heads. And so they're playing together. And so it would be very sad if 2 years ago, when this team's going to be really good, and I think it will, that it might be playing in Anaheim at that point.
Marcus Bertone of the Sacramento Bee is my guest. There's another issue where sports has entered the regular news, and that was this horrific attack on a Giants fan, a San Francisco Giants fan, who went down to the a game in Los Angeles against the Dodgers. He was attacked, and he is very seriously injured.
Very seriously injured. He has suffered a significant brain injury, and the gentleman is he's actually a paramedic himself from Santa Cruz, 42, father of two. Unless new information arises and we learn something different, it appears he was attacked simply for wearing a San Francisco Giants hat and was attacked by people down there who didn't like that. That, to me, as someone who's gone to games for 40 years, is horribly troubling. And this is a venerable public space in California. You should be able to go to a game in California wearing the hat you choose without fear for your life.
You were at that game, weren't you?
I was.
Was there a weird atmosphere there?
There was a raucous atmosphere, and it did, I've been going to Dodger Stadium since the mid-80s. It has seemed different there lately, more boisterous. It used to be a very laid-back crowd. Look, I mean, they won multiple.
It's LA.
I mean, they won multiple championships in years past, and they had a reason to feel blasé about the whole thing. But the last several times I've gone, I had noticed a different feeling, a different vibe, more aggressive, more whatever. And in this case, it was very boisterous. It was a good atmosphere. And I remember walking to our rental car that night because we covered the game for the B, and seeing a large number of police cars in the parking lot and thinking, well, somebody must have gotten drunk, and it wasn't really until the next day that the news began to spread as to what had really happened.
Well, and hopefully he will recover, but it's really not certain at this point.
It's not certain. They are actually fearful that he's suffered permanent brain damage from this, which would be just a horrible, horrible thing to have happen.
Finally, Marcus, and this to me seems like such a quintessential Sacramento story. It's a dispute over the claw, this thing that goes through some older neighborhoods in the
yes.
city. It's like the water meter thing. There are some people seem to feel they have a birthright to have this big machine come through their neighborhood and scoop up all the leaves instead of putting it in a bin like most people
yeah.
do. And the city council is considering getting tough. But I note that the vast majority of the streets where the claw prowls are in Midtown, Land Park, Curtis Park, the Pocket in East Sacramento. In other words, the neighborhoods where the most lawyers, lobbyists,
yes.
lawmakers, and journalists live.
Yes, yes. Now,
so forget about it.
You don't include me in this, buddy. I've had many a petition come to my household, and no. I do not participate in such things. Whatever the city does is fine with me. But it is funny in that you just mentioned all these neighborhoods of very connected people who have a way of having their opinions heard, and not even in a boisterous way or in a strident way, but just being able to know the pressure points of the representatives. And so, yes, it is very quintessentially Sacramento. It's incredibly passive-aggressive, and, of course, it has to do with leaves. God bless our little town. We're losing the Kings. We can't seem to attract any business, but God darn it, we're going to get worked up over leaves.
And as I understand, there are laws currently forbidding the city from requiring lawn waste bins, and those date back to the 40s. That is just unbelievable.
It is and it isn't. Sacramento is a unique place. I love it here. I've lived here for 20 years, but there are some times where you do have to shake your head.
Marcus Bertone shakes his head from time to time. His column appears in the Bee on Wednesdays and Sundays, and he's an Insight the first Wednesday of every month. Marcus, thanks for joining
us. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, one of America's top ethicists proposes three unexpected solutions to the debate over abortion. To Insight from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later this morning on Talk of the Nation, NPR's political junkie talks about federal budget showdowns and shutdowns, also President Obama declaring earlier that he's running again, and former poet laureate Billy Collins on the art and business of poetry. Talk of the Nation starts at 11. The philosophical study of ethics might sound esoteric, and sometimes it is, but ethics is also central to many of the biggest dilemmas, debates, and controversies that we face, such as abortion. A top ethicist is in town as a visiting professor at Sacramento State. He's Anthony Weston, professor of philosophy and environmental studies and chair of the philosophy department at Elon University in North Carolina. He gave a couple of talks this week, one on the pragmatic spirit in ethics and one on three unexpected solutions to the debate over abortion. We're going to talk about all that with him. Anthony Weston, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
It's such a great title, Abortion, Three Unexpected Solutions.
Yes. Well, I don't want to pretend to have some kind of secret either, because coming in as some kind of expert, it's really much more, particularly a pragmatic approach to things, is much more about empowering skills and understandings that we already have but tend to get disengaged in the way the debate is framed. So for one thing, I'm very interested in reframing the debate in a way that makes it, that engages all the different sides primary values, which I see as compatible, and engages them in working together in a collaborative kind of way to solve the problem. So really, for me, the unexpected solutions are not that unexpected, except the way the debate is framed as such an oppositional thing. And I could give an example.
Go ahead.
Sure. Both sides typically are framed as opposites, as simple as opposites, and only one of them can be right. But just in the simplest way, we're all pro-life and we're all pro-choice. We all care about both values. If you think of it, just for sort of remarkable.
That's right. Who's against life? Who's against choice?
Exactly, precisely. So if we start there, this is such simple stuff and yet so hard to kind of get a grip on in the way the debate is framed. But if you start there and you say, oh, we really care about both values and we care about them deeply, then it's a problem that we have to collaborate on to solve. Here's a situation where they conflict or seem to conflict. Sometimes they wouldn't have to if we set up things in a different way. The two sides could work together to try to figure out how to head the problem off in the first place, for example.
But aren't those terms pro-life and pro-choice a form of spin? Weren't they both created
exactly.
by both sides to put a, well, just to present what they would consider their best face to the public? And how do we know that that's really, that those are real terms and they're not just spin?
They're partly true. I mean, we do care about life, and a lot of values center around life that have nothing to do with abortion in particular, but and birth in general and caring for each other and community and how we face death and all those. Mm-hmm. So life, I'm happy with life. Choice, too. It's only that they don't exclude each other. The terms that are more problematic, it seems to me, are pro-abortion, anti-abortion, particularly pro-abortion, which is, that really is a spin term because yes. No one is pro-abortion, really. It's just that the so-called pro-choice
pro-abortion
side.
Rights.
Yeah, exactly. The pro-choice side thinks that abortion needs to be sometimes a legal option, as the least bad option, but no one's pro-abortion. If you start there, say, well, both sides agree abortion should be as minimized as possible for different reasons and in different ways, no doubt, but right there, there's a place to collaborate. See, that's so simple. I mean, you just simply shift the framework to the point of recognizing that the other side is not the other side. You're really on the same side. You weigh things a little differently. You have different sets of concerns. You come out of a different place in the culture, maybe. But that doesn't mean you can't work together. In fact, the sides have worked together and repeatedly in the past. A number of organizations working on, there's one called the Common Ground Network for Life and Choice. What an interesting idea. Life and
yes.
Choice and Common Ground. Starting to identify the places where the two sides agree. With all sorts of places where the two sides agree, and then working to promote, in particular, alternatives to, well, sometimes it's things like adoption, making adoption possible. Sometimes it's things like access to contraception. Sometimes it's things like reducing the economic or social disadvantages of having a child at an unexpected time, all those sorts of things. Both sides agree about those things. Those are big, serious tasks, but they're not impossible, and they're not oppositional either, really.
My guest is Anthony Weston. He's an ethicist and a visiting scholar at Sacramento State. Yesterday, he gave a couple of public talks, one of them, three unexpected solutions to the debate over abortion. Any other solutions?
I was going to say I'm a visiting optimist. I really believe in
yes.
this stuff. Well, a whole range of things. So I've been talking a little bit more about prevention, about, you know, really heading off. I said this to the students yesterday, you know, we understand, I think, sometimes you need to restructure the problem before it even arises. A simple example would be like kids with, you're a parent, let's say, and you've got kids and you have two kids and one lollipop, let's say, you know already that's
trouble.
So the solution to that is to have two lollipops. So, you know, but that's not to figure out how to deal with one lollipop, it's to change the problem. So a whole range of solutions like that are, as it were, solutions that we can all reach together like that. But other kinds of things, another quite different example, one of the assumptions we tend to make in the whole debate as it stands is that we become a human being at some single moment. So a human being is either a quality you have completely or you don't have it at all. And so that assumption already drives the debate to extremes, because what typically happens in these arguments is that people go, well, since fetal development is so gradual, either this radical change of state has to happen at the very beginning or the very end, because there's no place in between that it may be viability. People argue about that, but typically it's one extreme or the other. But that assumption seems to me clearly at least questionable. That is, that there has to be a single point at which human being kind of descends on an object that up until then had no moral standing and no development and no anything. I mean, very few things in the world are like that. You know, I used yesterday with the students the example of being a good swimmer or being an adult or being a Southerner. I grew up in Wisconsin, but but I live in North Carolina for 20 years. You could become, gradually you become, or a good driver even, or a driver, just plain old driver, you know, it's a gradual process. What if fetal development were, precisely the gradualness of fetal development were honored, and we said, well, humanity develops slowly. Therefore, moral standing, the weight of the claim of the fetal life to rights or right moral standing, however you want to describe that, that also increases gradually. And so you have a kind of gradualism about it. At the beginning, you have relatively few restrictions in the early stages of pregnancy. Later on, more. Later on, quite a lot. I would say that's both a pro-life and a pro-choice view.
Well, all of this sounds very appealing, very sensible. Do you know, though, how well it would translate from a philosophy classroom to the real world of people debating over abortion?
Well, as I say, there are organizations that are already devoted to this kind of thing, the Network for Life and Choice. Another interesting one is a group around Sojourners, the Catholic, I guess you'd say progressive liberal Catholic journal, but there's an organization around. They're particularly interested in working together with who exactly? I mean, they're Catholic, so they're sort of defined as pro-life, but they're actually progressively oriented, so they tend to be more kind of politically pro-choice. But they're working, they say things like, well, if we all agree that abortion is not a good thing by itself, let's do everything we can to make it as rare as possible. That doesn't mean banning it by law. It means changing the situation so that women aren't put in that desperate a situation, they're not pregnant in the first place, all those kinds of things. So the point is, there are organizations that are already working on this kind of thing. The other thing I would say, as to myself, this real-world distinction. I believe I live in the real world. I believe philosophy is the real world, so I want to work on that side. This story I was telling about thinking about fetal development as gradual and that moral standing growing gradually is a tricky topic, but it's roughly compatible structurally with Roe versus Wade. That is, because although the Roe has a different rationale, but nonetheless, this idea of gradually increasing restrictions from relatively unrestricted to relatively restricted through the course of pregnancy is the Roe structure. So if you think of it that way, that's a workable legal structure right there. I mean, controversy isn't about the workability of it, as it were. It's about, you know, if you have the assumption that humanity begins at conception, then you're kind of over that before it even starts, as it were. But as to workability, yeah, that's a workable legal structure. And I think it could be what it really needs is to be complemented by structures of counseling, of moral understandings, of understanding that this is a serious business, that if you are going to make a choice to terminate a pregnancy, it needs to be early, social support for earlier detection, for understanding of, over the whole society, understanding of the seriousness of the whole situation.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago Catholics when talking about abortion, and it seems to me that there are many Catholics who are pro-life when it comes to abortion, but they're actually pro-life across the board.
Absolutely.
In other words, they're against abortion, but they're also against the death penalty, they're against war, and so
yes.
on. And that seems to me to be a unique characteristic there of Catholics when it comes to this issue.
Well, you're talking about real-world moral philosophy. That's real-world moral philosophy to say, because on the one hand, it's saying if we're going to be pro-life about this issue, for them, it's the other way around. They are pro-life across the board. Therefore,
yes.
They're pro-life about this, but also about war, about economic justice, about a whole range of things that don't sit well with
So they find themselves intersecting with both liberal and conservative political views,
yeah.
depending on what the issue is.
Yes, yes. There is, to give fair credit, there is a Protestant... what is it called? There's a name which I'm forgetting. I'm sorry, but a Protestant equivalent that essentially
yes.
says pro-life across the board. But they tend to be at odds with the typical militant pro-life organizations,
yeah.
which tend to be pretty focused on just on abortion. But I think the general point there is the pro-life movement is diverse.
Mm.
It's not one simple thing about one simple thing. It's a whole variety of different groups interested in different things in a wide range of topics. And to me, that makes it more solvable, the whole issue. You can approach it in a variety of ways. And last thing, one of the things I've learned from talking to pro-choice people is how they have really interesting and supportive liaisons with Catholics because of other issues that they work, like economic justice and anti-war. And then it comes around to the abortion issue. They can't disconnect because they know and respect these people. Each side knows and respects each other already because they have such close collaboration on other pro-life issues. So that gets everybody thinking, and they're much more inclined to be collaborative and at least listen to each other. So all this is positive, it seems to me.
Well, we'll have to wrap it up there. Anthony Weston, professor of philosophy and chair of the philosophy department at Elon University in North Carolina. He's a visiting ethics scholar at Sacramento State. Yesterday, he gave two talks, one on the pragmatic spirit in ethics and the other, a practical application of that pragmatic spirit, solutions to the debate over abortion. Anthony Weston, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, and take heart.
I will.
That's my message.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how technology and globalization are changing the way law is practiced.
Public Radio. You can join us for a second Saturday artist reception this weekend as Sacramento artist Bob Miller exhibits his watercolor and ink sketchbook at our Folsom Boulevard studios. That's Saturday from 6 p.m. to 9. Reception sponsored by mercyorthopedics.org. capradio.org/events for more details. We get support from KVIE. Tonight, Viewfinder exposes homegrown talent and young composers as they blossom into professional musicians. Tonight at 7 on KVIE Channel 6. And from the Downtown Stockton Alliance, presenting A New Eye on Downtown Stockton, a summit to discuss sustainable economic development in Stockton's downtown core. April 19th at 8:30 a.m. at the Bob Hope Theater. Registration at downtownstocktonsummit.com. This is Capital Public Radio.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow we'll talk about hate crimes, civil rights violations, human trafficking, and more with Ben Wagner, U.S. Attorney in Sacramento. Also, how big budget cuts are affecting California's public higher education system. Back to today. Many occupations have changed, left the country, or disappeared because of technology and globalization. You might think a highly specialized field like law would be above the fray, but it's not. Big changes are happening in legal practice because of technology and globalization. Joining us to talk about this is Paul Payton, professor at University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento and director of the school's Ethics Across the Professions Initiative. He hosts a day-long conference, a symposium this Friday, on how technology and globalization are changing the delivery of legal practice. Paul Payton, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Well, let's start with technology. Technology has allowed people to work more efficiently, but it's also allowed jobs to basically move elsewhere. Are we seeing that as well in law?
Absolutely. And you actually have two different sets of phenomena going on right now. You have the rise of what's called the virtual law office. It used to be bricks and mortar. You would go see a lawyer at a downtown office. Now you can access lawyers and legal services online from the comfort of your home, and you don't necessarily know where they're based. That has a whole set of ramifications in terms of the way that law is practiced and offered.
Are there downsides?
There are all sorts of risks. One of the things, for lawyers at least, is knowing your client. It may be that the client's trying to take advantage of the lawyer. Money laundering issues sometimes end up coming up, whether you meet the client in person or not. I think the other risk is that you lose some of that face-to-face benefit of contact, assessing people in person, being able to reach out to them in person. I'm a fan myself of in-person client contact, but I think there's tremendous power in the way that technology can provide legal services to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to access them.
Every state and every country has its own legal system. If you go to see a lawyer in an office in Sacramento, it's fairly safe to assume that person is up to speed, or at least more or less up to speed, with California legal practice. But if you are going to someone in a virtual law office, they could be in Bangalore. How would you know that they really know what the law is where you are?
Well, and that's something that actually regulators in the United States and elsewhere are grappling with. There was an issues paper that just came out this week from regulators in Australia trying to grapple with this. I think what the regulators are trying to do is say, look, promote yourselves as a California lawyer. Have that on your website so that clients know. To a certain extent, it's buyer beware. The question then comes up, okay, what kind of contact are you going to have with the client? And if you are dealing with a lawyer in Sacramento, is he or she outsourcing some of that other work to Bangalore? That's where other problems end up arising. But you now have all sorts of worldwide webs of lawyers, law firms, Even just information being stored offsite or offshore. Lawyers are participating in cloud computing. How safe are your files? All these sorts of issues end up arising when you talk about a virtual legal practice or the use of technology in anything, but in particular in law.
It seemed that the earliest jobs that started to disappear because of technology were lower skilled jobs. But I've heard it said that any job that involves the processing of information at whatever level, whatever skill level, could be moved overseas.
Well, and the other thing that ends up coming up in that respect is actually the way that lawyers are trained. Increasingly, you have all sorts of lawyers getting very good legal educations in the United States and then returning to other countries. You have two different sets of phenomena going on. Things like document review, a feature, unfortunately, of so many trials, thousands upon thousands of documents. You can have very good trained lawyers. India is a common law system. The legal education there is very sound, who are able to do that work on a supervised basis. And I think that supervision is important by an American lawyer who then takes responsibility for the work. So you're seeing outsourcing to India. You're also seeing, with the transformation of the legal economy in the United States, insourcing. So all of a sudden you have document review services that might have gone to Bangalore or elsewhere overseas going to North Dakota and Ohio and other areas where it's economically depressed and lawyers are having difficulty getting jobs.
We're talking about how globalization and technology are changing the practice of law. That's the topic of a symposium at University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law on Friday. My guest is the professor who's organizing the symposium, Paul Payton. One of your panelists is general counsel at LegalZoom. What's LegalZoom?
A lot of lawyers would substitute enemy for LegalZoom. LegalZoom is one of, and there are a number of different document providers. They tap into a market where people are wanting access to legal documents or to try and engage in what we call self-help. So you can go online to various websites, pull off something like a promissory note or a draft contract, fill in the blanks and think that you've got a legally binding document. There's obviously a market for this. You have to pay a price for it. They're not offering legal advice, but thousands of people are taking advantage of it. They advertise very heavily. And so I thought it important to actually have a representative from that part of the market as part of the discussion, because that is also a feature of the way that technology is changing legal practice.
And why are some lawyers, or even many lawyers, opposed to LegalZoom? Is it because they have legitimate concerns about what that could mean for clients, or is it because it's taking their business, or both?
I think it's a combination of the two. And I think one of the things that the legal profession hasn't necessarily been known for is innovation in terms of the way in which services are provided. And there is great concern, though, that people helping themselves won't necessarily know what all the ramifications are. With a lot of contracts, with a lot of promissory notes, other services, people think it is just lawyers filling in the blanks, but there's a lot that goes into it when you're advising a client, and there's legitimate concern that where people are engaging in self-help, they'll need lawyers afterwards to try and clean up what is an unfortunate mess. So I think there's an opportunity for collaboration. Legal regulators are looking also at letting lawyers provide what are called sort of partial source or partial representation, so that clients can come to lawyers not for a sort of stem to stern review of something, but just one part of the puzzle.
There's another topic being discussed at your symposium, which I find quite interesting to think about. It's titled Democratizing the Delivery of Legal Services. And as I understand, professional conduct rules across the United States ban corporations from owning or investing in law firms. But that doesn't necessarily mean to say that there couldn't be some benefits to consumers, to clients, if there were some kind of corporate ownership. For example, the way Walmart has been able to make more efficient the selling of generic drugs.
This is another hugely important area, and one in which I'm engaged with the American Bar Association's Ethics 2020 Commission, which was set up last year to explore a whole bunch of issues arising from the way in which technology and globalization is changing legal practice. One of those areas, and this is happening in England and in Australia, is what's called alternative business structures. Those include things like multidisciplinary practice, but it also includes investments by individuals into law firms. In Australia, you actually have a law firm that is publicly traded on the Australian Stock Exchange. I'm not sure how good an investment it is, but at least they've allowed passive, non-lawyer equity investment to allow for greater access to the marketplace. In England, they talk about Tesco law, people being able to access legal services through their local supermarket. So changes are afoot elsewhere. American lawyers and American law firms are participating in those markets. These are issues that need to be explored domestically.
And I said earlier that the Walmart has, in some ways, made more efficient the selling of generic drugs. But the flip side of that is, in the most recent issue of Consumer Reports, there was a chart evaluating customer service at all kinds of pharmacies, and Walmart was at the very bottom of the list. So I guess it doesn't necessarily mean to say you get good service, although you might get cheaper service.
Well, and one of the big ethical issues is the independence of the lawyer's judgment. There's a huge tradition, and an extremely important one, that the lawyer has to render candid advice and exercise independent professional judgment when you're providing advice to clients. If you're in one of the fears of being in a corporate atmosphere is that somehow the lawyer's going to be forced to compromise in terms of the advice that's being rendered or the direction that a case is going because of other economic considerations that they don't control.
Yeah, I mean, let's say you wanted to sue Walmart and Walmart had a stake in the corporately owned law firm that you go to.
Well, that provides a conflict of interest concern that would exist already. But in terms of actually squeezing the market, you know, you get concerns again about concentration of firms. But that's a phenomenon that's also been happening with mergers and acquisitions globally. Got news this week of another merger that now has created a worldwide firm based in the United States, but also with English and Australian offices, that now has 4,000 lawyers in it. So people talk about not being able to get representation. Conflicts of interest concerns end up arising. You know, who can you retain if they're representing a Walmart or another corporation that you want to end up suing?
Finally, Paul Payton, technology and globalization's impact on the legal profession is the topic of the symposium, but it's also of interest to the American Bar Association, and you were recently named to a position called reporter to their Ethics 2020 Commission, which will be reviewing the rules and regulations of lawyer conduct in the context of advances in technology and developments in global legal practice. So I guess these issues are of pressing concern to the whole legal profession.
Absolutely. And what the American Bar Association's commission has been tasked with doing is actually taking a look at the ways in which the professional conduct rules governing lawyers are responding to these issues across a whole variety of areas. The commission's having open hearings, issues papers that are being drafted are being posted on the ABA's website, and they provide, I think, some insight as to the concern for lawyers, but also the concern in terms of protecting the public interest as well as the core professional values. One of the things that the commission is focused on in large part is whether or not it's, you know, is this old wine in new bottles? Are all of the developments just simply changes that the rules already respond to, or do we need more rules in order to be able to govern it? I've been deeply engaged in some of the work since the appointment in December, and I'm fascinated by the interconnectedness of it all. It's been a great journey.
I can imagine. Paul Payton, professor at University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento, director of the school's Ethics Across the Professions Initiative, and he hosts a symposium this Friday on how technology and globalization is changing the practice of law. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, Western author Thomas McGuane, he's coming to Sacramento. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our website is capradio.org/insight. Lots of information there, photographs and links so that you can follow our show on Facebook and me on Twitter and lots more. This afternoon on Capital Public Radio News, California beekeepers are upset about a plan to raise money from them. A research commission set up to investigate the mysterious collapse of bee populations proposes raising its funds from beekeepers, but many of them say the profits are so slim or non-existent they can't afford an assessment. That story and more during All Things Considered here on Capital Public Radio. Novelist and essayist Thomas McGuane, best known for his books about the West and the outdoors, is coming to town. The Montana-based author speaks tonight in Sacramento. His latest book is Driving on the Rim. It's a novel about a doctor who's an eccentric outsider in a Western town. It's McGuane's 10th novel. He's also written several works of short fiction, nonfiction, and screenplays. He joins us on the phone. Thomas McGuane, thanks for being on Insight today.
Thank you for inviting me.
You were scheduled to speak in Sacramento last November, but you had to reschedule at short notice because of a family emergency. May I ask what the emergency was?
Well, it was a sad business. My son's wife, who was kind of the center of our family in many ways, had just gone into hospice care for cancer and was expected to be there for quite a long time. And so I kind of reluctantly set out on day one of a book tour. And I was down here just a day when I heard that she was not expected to last another day. So I canceled and went home and was in time to spend a little bit of time with Michelle, and then she passed away. So that was that.
Well, we're sorry to hear about that, but naturally your many fans are pleased that you are able to come to Sacramento today. Now, you are closely associated with Montana specifically in the West in general, but you're actually from Michigan. How did you come to move to Montana?
Well, it was kind of an accident. I had a job in the area in high school, and I liked it so much I wanted to try to find a way to live there. And as soon as I got out of school, I went back to Montana. I've been there most of my life now, over 43 or 44 years, something like that. So it's definitely my home. In addition to that, I kind of grew up in Michigan because my father had a job there. I didn't have family there, so it was not a tough transition to move elsewhere.
What is it about Montana that inspires and informs your writing?
Well, it's a wonderful place to live. It's been a great place for me to pursue the things that I love. I'm an outdoorsman, and it's been a good place to raise a family. I like the low population levels. We're still under 1 million people in the fourth largest state in the union. The winters are a challenge. They have been, particularly this year. For some reason or another, it seems to be a literate place. There are a lot of writers in Montana, lots of universities. It's an area of intense book reading, and it's a comfortable place to live. And over the last 35 years or so, I've been kind of in the cattle business and ranching, so that's held me there.
My guest is Thomas McGuane, the novelist and essayist. His latest book is the novel Driving on the Rim, and he speaks in Sacramento tonight at the Crest Theater. Your latest book came out late last year, your latest novel, and that was 8 years after your previous novel. Why did 8 years elapse?
Well, don't forget I wrote a collection of stories in that period of time, which... most of which appeared in The New Yorker, and three of them were selected for Best American Stories. So I was working all that time. Stories are so hard to write, it was a relief to go back to novels. And then I have a ranch to run, so all that has to happen at the same time. And I think age-wise, ideas for novels don't come as rapidly as they used to. The enthusiasm to write them maybe not as intense. But once I kind of lined up on this one, I really didn't want to do anything else. I seemed to tap into old preoccupations of mine. So hopefully it won't be another 8 years.
You said you have a ranch to run. I'm sure some people have a romantic notion about what that involves. What's it actually like?
Well, it's not as tough as it was. We, at one point or another, I ran, 250 or 300 mother cows and made alfalfa to feed for 7 months of the year. And it's a much simpler operation now. I just run yearling cattle, brood mares, and I don't raise hay anymore. I've converted all the hay meadows back into native pasture. So it's a little bit simpler. It can be run on the back of a horse rather than on the back of a tractor. But still, it takes up a lot of time. It's nearly a full-time job. Formerly, it was more than a full-time job. But it's a nice fit for me. I don't living where I do would be very hard to stay in the house any longer than I do.
Mm. What is it about fly fishing in Montana? They're so closely associated. What is so good about the fly fishing in Montana?
Well, it's really it's really the kind of epicenter of American fly fishing, just because of all the tremendous rivers, particularly the headwaters of the Missouri system, the Madison, the Jefferson, the Gallatin, the Yellowstone. There's just so much of it. And it seems to be a natural habitat for trout. I saw the Fish and Wildlife shocking a stream on the edge of the Walmart parking lot in Bozeman, and there was a nice trout every 10 feet all the way around the edge of the tarmac. So trout seem to want to live there for some reason. I think that little stream at the edge of the Walmart parking lot would be one of the better trout streams in New England.
The trout like to live there, but the people who catch the trout also like to live there.
Well, they like to live there. They certainly like to come there in the nice months. I've fished all my life. My father fished all his life. My grandfather fished all his life. It's just kind of part of what we do. It's kind of our golf, I guess.
Thomas McGuane's latest book is the novel Driving on the Rim. The main character in your book has a curious name, Burl Pickett. Where did you get that name from?
Well, his mother was kind of a simple person and a patriot, and she named him after Irving Berlin, who wrote God Bless America. So his full name is Irving Berlin Pickett, which helps sort of substantiate my view that in our country, the apple often falls a long way from the tree. And he kind of embraces his name, I think, and I hope it fits him.
But he stands out somewhat in the small town where he's a doctor.
He does. For a long time, has the status of a kind of an outcast, partly because of his own peculiarity, partly because of the outsider nature of his parents and their peculiar ways of living. His mother's is a holy roller. His father is a disgruntled old veteran. And he's a kind of a non-fit wherever he goes, which serves my purposes in kind of scrutinizing the community and American life in general.
Mm. Where did you get the inspiration for Burl Pickett and for the book Driving on the Rim? Does it come from sitting in your office and imagining people and scenarios, or does it come from being out places and observing people and things?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I'm a great sort of spy. I love to kind of watch what's going on around me. I mean, if I stop for gas, I always slip into the service bay and see what they're working on and talk to the guys in there. I mean, that's just kind of my approach. And I think that kind of accretes over time and sort of solidifies in individual characters you think that represent what you've seen and what you think.
Mm. Looking at your the books you've written over the years, mainly novels, but you've written screenplays, you've written short stories, and you've written quite a few collections of essays about outdoor life, outdoor sports. When you were starting out as a writer, what kind of writer did you see yourself being?
I think I saw myself as being a comic writer. You know, I was very interested. I grew up as a writer. I kind of grew up in the sort of black humor period when our heroes were Evelyn Waugh and J.P. Donlevy and some of Joyce and I've always revered the great comic writers, particularly Cervantes. But that didn't quite stick entirely. I mean, it's part of what I do. I still am interested in writers, and I'm glad to see this coming back in some of the young writers who seem to have a sense of humor. We've come from a long sort of morose period in literary fiction. That's kind of what I thought. I knew I was not going to be an academician, so I knew I would have to be a flexible sort of writer, and indeed I have done everything I have had to do to survive by my writing. And that's taken me places where I was not necessarily originally interested. I was never particularly interested in movies, for example, but I worked a lot in the movie business. And I was never interested in journalism. I've done a lot of that.
Yes.
So that was that. I just have scrambled, really.
Well, it's turned out pretty well for scrambling. Thomas McGuane, novelist, essayist. His latest book is the novel Driving on the Rim. He speaks in Sacramento tonight for California Lectures. It starts at 7:30 at Sacramento's Crest Theater. Thomas McGuane, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to me.
It was a pleasure.
Okay.
That's Insight for today. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers, Sosin Marar and Liz Cazares. The technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer is Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Under Governor Brown's current budget proposal, public higher education faces a cumulative budget reduction of at least $1.4 billion. On the next Insight, where will the cuts be made and how would they impact students and faculty? Also, we'll talk about civil rights violations and hate crimes with a U.S. attorney based in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.